Hello, this is Bob Dobbs again, and it is July 17, 2014. We're doing part five in our conversation with Dennis Young. Dennis Young is a professor emeritus of art history at the Nova Scotia College of Art and Design University in Halifax. Now, we've been going through his article that he wrote about 12 years ago called Painting and Its Paradigms, and you can follow along with us at the website dennis-young.ca. And just scroll down, see a lot of articles there, and you'll see Painting and Its Paradigms. But we're not actually following it at this moment. We started in the last part four session to go into a theory unique to Dennis Young, it seems, where he sees 100 years ago two trends in painting. There were the painters who aligned with the architects, and then there was the other school, which we're going to focus more on today, the painters aligning with the poets. Dennis, I think you have a couple of points you want to make based on part four and the painting and architect school trend. You want to make a correction or two there?
Yes, I want to say just one or two more words about Corbusier. But before I do, just let me remind anybody who's listening to this that the division that I've made between artists on the one hand associating with architects and artists or painters who associate with poets could be put in another way. It could be put so that painters allied with architects are interested in transforming the human habitat externally, so to speak, outside the human body. But the alliance with poets and painters is a transformation, aiming at a transformation of the inner person. It's irrational, whereas the architects are rational. So you can make that kind of distinction, and that helps to cement the theory that, on the whole, in the period between the two wars and a little bit afterwards, there was this separation, for the most part, between, on the one hand, poets and painters, and we'll see what I mean by transforming the inner person.
Yes, yeah, so one is the aesthetic sociology, and the other, the architecture would be that, and the personal would be aestheticizing the psychology. That's the painter.
If you like, you could put it that way.
Right.
But I like to compare it more with irrationalism and rationalism.
Right.
Because the architects have to be rational, all their stuff will fall down. I'd just like to say, too, a couple of things about Le Corbusier. As you know, his name, as we said last time, was really Jeanneret, and he changed his name to Le Corbusier. He was a friend of a painter called Aux Enfants,
yes.
And the two of them worked together. And towards the end of the war, there was a sort of touch of what you might call cubism about what they were doing, but it was a very geometric cubism. Corbusier wrote in a journal that he called the new spirit, L'Esprit Nouveau, in 1917, what is known as a recall to order. What he seemed to have meant by the recall to order was that, on the whole, the arts had been breaking up. And what he wanted to do was to reestablish at least architecture in the tradition of Platonic rationalism. So it's sometimes said that he wanted to put Plato in the engine room.
Mm.
And I think that's a nice way to put it. His recall to order was in many ways a recall to geometry, but it was not a simple geometry. As we said before, it was the Fibonacci geometry, if you like. At the beginning, he did seem more geometric, and it wasn't until a bit later, really much closer to the Second World War, so during the 20s and 30s, a lot of his designs, I would hate to put dates to them now, but they were more, perhaps, geometric and based on the modular system.
Mm.
Now, we talked about the modular system, and they were following that in a way. houses that it was possible to make in a factory. He called them, many of his common designs that he made for normal residential workers' housing and so on, he called them Citroën, which is a sort of pun on the name of the motor car firm, Citroën.
Right.
And so, you know, he was saying, well, these houses can be made like cars if they're modular. And that was what he set about. Now, as I'm trying to say, it wasn't until he was basically coming to the Second World War, and I wouldn't care to give a date to this either, but I know that in 1950, I was in Marseille, and I took a trip out, 10 miles out of Marseille, to see his most famous building, perhaps, which was on the edge of a small town, which he had built in raw concrete. In short, what's called brut in French, and became called brutalism in English. You find it, for instance, if you remember being at Dalhousie, you can see it in the Dalhousie Arts Centre here in Halifax.
Yes.
You can see it in a lot of places. That raw concrete can be made to look quite good, as almost as good as stone, if you're clever, let's put it that way. I wouldn't go into what you have to do to work on it.
So what is non-raw concrete?
You'd still be on concrete, but you'd cover the concrete with some kind of confetti. You know, you'd cover it. It's common now to do that. The building is said to be clad in something or other. We even have a building near me in Halifax that was built only 3 years ago, a large apartment building, that has one part of the concrete covered in wooden shingles. I mean, this is the reductio ad absurdum of anything, and the building, in my estimation, is obscene. But there it was. Part of it's covered in wood shingles, which makes no sense at all, of course.
Well, was Le Corbusier original to design with raw concrete?
Yes, he really was. I mean, there might have been raw concrete in a factory building, an industrial building.
Yes.
But in what he called his unité d'habitation, his unity of habitation, or his what we would call an apartment building just outside Marseille. Now, for that, he used this Fibonacci system that he was inventing just before the war. I didn't make that clear, I think. I think I implied that he had it from the First World War, but it really wasn't until the Second World War that he came up with that. And so everywhere around the building, well, in many places in the building, you can see a strange-looking mannequin with his hand raised. And you can break down the proportions of this mannequin, and they come out as Fibonacci numbers.
You said he applied or thought about the Fibonacci series or design before World War One, but he didn't apply it until before World War Two. Is that what
you're saying? Yes, this is why I'm trying to correct it. If I implied that he was from the very start involved in Fibonacci, that is quite wrong.
Right, I see.
When he was a student with Behrens, that wasn't in a case. You can see some of his houses in the 30s that are almost certainly not Fibonacci houses when he built for Gertrude Stein, for instance.
Mm.
They're much more geometric, and they're slightly allied to de Stael, too, in their sort of horizontal and vertical emphases. But he invented this mannequin that he called the modulor. And so when I said modulor last time, I was not distinguishing between his mannequin and the idea of the modular house.
Right.
I should add that the modular house, and remember we talked about that, we said that was an invention of the middle 19th century, and the individual who built the Crystal Palace. I should add that there's a whole list of very important names that he was preferred over when he did that. He designed the entire Crystal Palace in 8 days.
And you're saying the guy who designed the Crystal Palace was an upstart? he knocked out a lot of more famous architects. Is that what you're
saying?
Yes,
he did. Yeah. Yes, and of course he was a greenhouse designer who had never taken on anything of that scale. But nevertheless, he wasn't deterred, and he created the design within 8 days. Well, let's move on, because I want to start our topic for today. And the best way to start the topic for today is, first of all, to draw attention to a phenomenon that we haven't talked about very much, and that is the development of the cabaret, particularly in France. Everything that France did was copied somewhere, and you find that by the beginning of the 20th century, you found cabarets in Germany and in Vienna and so on. So I just wanted to say a little bit about the cabaret. The cabaret, in a way, originally was a low-life kind of beer pub, if you like. It got tangled up, and the words got tangled up, with a form of the salon that we never discussed. Well, we might have touched upon it, but because I think we mentioned, for instance, that people went to see Mallarmé on Tuesday nights.
Yes.
And that would be a sort of salon. But it could well be that the correct word to have used even for Mallarmé's meetings was cénacle, C-E-N-A-C-L-E,
right,
with an accent over the A.
Mm.
It's worth perhaps just saying a little bit about that. The person who may be said to have led this transformation from the old beer shop cabaret to a more sophisticated intellectual meeting was, at least his family name was Salis, S-A-L-I-S. He was a wealthy fellow, in fact an aristocrat, but he was an unusual aristocrat because also an anarchist. Rudolf Salis comes to my mind. That was his name.
Mm.
And he had a group of artists and thinkers who met at his house. And then he moved the house and took a place in Montmartre, where the art world was, and which was at that time a village outside the boundaries of Paris, although it isn't that today. It was a place becoming famous for its circuses, its dance halls, cafes, café concert, as they used to be, with entertainment, and for its crime and prostitution and drugs.
Those would be the scenes that Toulouse-Lautrec would paint.
Yes, that's exactly so. I'm glad you mentioned Toulouse-Lautrec. He was very present in those places, and he drew and painted quite a bit about them. Salis, or Sally, turned the cénacle into one of these sort of strange clubs, where people mixed intellectuals with sexual people and so on. The membership of these places, you didn't have to pay, and you just came along for a drink or something and to enjoy what was going on there. He called his place, and it's a very famous place, this is why I wanted to just point it out to him. In the end, when he'd finally moved and reestablished the location, he called it the Black Cat, Le Chat Noir. Mm. And you'll see Lautrec illustrating posters for Le Chat Noir, and also showing on those the people who would perform in the cabarets for your entertainment. It wasn't too long after that that this guy, Sally, started a magazine called The Black Cat as well.
And this is all in the 1890s?
This would be in the 1880s. Actually.
1880s, okay.
But as the 80s progressed, he did find that neighborhood was too rough, and he moved out and found a new and larger place about a mile away from it.
What did he think he was doing, Dennis? What was his motive
what you found was, and this is, I'm coming to it really, was that some of the places turned out to be anarchistic. And so the kind of songs you heard, the kind of jokes you heard and entertainment that you got tended to be hostile to the rich and friendly to the working poor,
right,
even though they may not have been there, even though the main number of guests would be fairly wealthy people on a night out. But they'd still get insulted. One of his premises was taken over by a man called Aristide Bruin. And this is another guy that Lautrec drew posters for.
Mm.
He took over the old Chat Noir, the Black Cat, and made it more coarse and crude. He spoke in the local argot of the streets. And if there are still records, there were records that were made in the 90s, you know, those cylindrical records being made.
Yeah.
And they have been put on discs. And I do have a disc of Aristide Bruin singing. I can't understand a word he says, of course, but I've had my Francophone friends come in and try to translate it. And one of the songs that he sings on it goes something like this. I was born in the street and my mother was a whore and, you know, so on. So, and he would address his guests as dung, another piece of dung, he'd say, as they came in the door. And then he began to label the place the rendezvous for those seeking to be abused.
Is Alfred Jarry part of this scene? Is that what Uber Roy, that play by Jarry?
Well, it's not clear to me that Jarry went to the
Black
cabaret,
Cat.
Although he probably did, because he drank a lot, of course. He drank himself to death, in fact.
Yeah.
But it was 1896 when he came up with Ubu, as you remember we agreed last time.
Yeah.
So it's not difficult to associate Jarry and his absurdities with Bruin and his absurdities and his rudeness and so on. Because, after all, Ubu starts with a word that you wouldn't normally hear today, or until today, at any rate.
Yeah.
On the stage, it starts with the word that sounds like shit.
Yes.
And when it's translated into English, it's generally written as shitre, just as the French word for shit is merde, and he used the word merdre. So I suppose if there was a law against that kind of language, then he would escape, because you'd always say, well, you know, it was merdre, not merde.
So, Dennis, you add an R-E to shit. Shitra is what you're saying.
Yes, in the translations, that's what it generally is. I mean, the whole point would be lost if you just said shit.
Right.
Because it really was an attempt to get these words through without getting arrested or something for breaking some kind of law, I think.
Right, and we should understand this is the Victorian era, and you got to be careful about...
Yes.
Obscenities and things like that.
That's
so,
just my guess.
Right. So what kind of music would be going on in the Black Cat?
Well, I would say it's the kind of music that you found in the streets, the accordion and whatever goes with them. I'm not sure. There might be some kind of a flute. There also might be bagpipey kind of things.
Mm.
But I don't know much about the music. It certainly wouldn't be a concert hall music.
Right. And where
there might be a piano, of course, because some of the people had considerable reputation. There was someone called Yvette Guilbert who sang in the new version of the Black Cat, which is called Le Mirliton, M-I-R-L-I-T-O-N, which means something like a cream cake or something of that kind. But when she sang sort of, oh, she was world-weary, aging, cynical, and a bit of a coquette as well. But the guy became Edward VII, after the death of his mother Victoria, patronized these places a lot. One of the people who sang in the cabarets had a name, La Goulou, obviously not her real name. She was said to be the mistress of the forthcoming Edward VII. I don't think he did this after he became king.
Right.
In his while he waited and grew gross and old, he became a decent king in a way. He was pretty smart and he did some good things. But maybe that was because he defied his mother, he defied the pettiness of the court, and he went his own way, much to her dismay, of course.
Right.
A lot of the time he was in Paris. Anyway, we mustn't say too much about the English aristocracy. I just wanted to draw attention to these cabarets and how they did develop, how they were pretty crude, and how they were bound almost to attract people with anarchist views. Now, they spread, and by the end of the century, they existed in other big cities in other countries in Europe, particularly in Berlin and in Vienna. And in Vienna, you had a fellow called Hugo Ball, B-A-L-L, who was an anarchist and who created a lot of disturbance. As you may know, Vienna was a place where a lot of disturbance was being made by literary people, although they weren't the kind of disturbance that we just talked about in the cabarets. They were much more serious, particularly about sexual life, which was so stilted. There was such a double standard in Vienna that some of the intellectuals who were also authors of plays were arrested for the content of their plays.
But would they be aware of Freud, who was in Vienna at that time? Would they be reading Freud, who he hadn't happened yet?
No, Freud had been publishing, I think, from the early 80s.
Oh, okay.
And so he would have been looked upon. And I mean, it's perhaps no coincidence that at the very time, he once said of one of those playwrights, you know, Freud said, you know, he's put on the stage everything that I've been talking about.
Ah.
I mean, it was a great tribute. Now, when the war came, when the First World War came, a lot of the people who were involved in this kind of thing, especially anarchism, refused to fight and looked for a way of getting out of countries that would require them to be drafted. And, of course, the one place in Europe where they all ended up was Switzerland, which was neutral.
Yeah.
In Switzerland, after the beginning of the war, you found a lot of disaffected and creative young men from all over Europe assembling themselves in Zurich.
And now you single Hugo Ball. Why did you mention him? He's coming from Vienna. Did he do something in Vienna?
Yes, he came from Vienna to Switzerland to escape the draft.
And he'd already been doing the cabaret in Vienna?
That's right.
I see. All right.
That's right. So in Zurich, where he was in 1916, and he had befriended a number of people whose names now we may recognize. I don't know whether everyone will recognize them, but the names that figured among his friends were Tristan Tzara, Hans Arp, Marcel Janko, or Hanko, and Richard Holsenbeck. Actually, I met Richard Holsenbeck, or Richard Holsenbeck, in Toronto in, I would say, 1964.
Really?
He was an old man. He was out of money, and he was touring, talking about his days in Zurich with the Dadaists to make money. When I say I met him, it didn't mean much, you know. I mean, a lot of people met him because he was anxious to make himself familiar with you. Anyway, so one or two of them were still around when and got as far as Toronto when I was there in 64. This group of people seemed to enjoy a romp. They enjoyed fun. They enjoyed insulting the bourgeoisie who had come in. They loved to be just stupid. And in a way, they might have been even funny. I don't know.
Yeah.
They're generally more funny when you talk about them than if you'd been there. But they looked for a name for themselves. And they opened the LaRousse dictionary at random, and they fell on the name. There are several stories about how the word Dada actually came. But it's... Now, I think, accepted that they just opened the LaRousse Dictionary and agreed that it had opened at DA and Dada was the name they assumed for themselves. It doesn't have a meaning, really. Mm. So they began a cabaret that they named after Voltaire, which was scarcely complimentary to Voltaire, who was obviously one of the great minds of the previous century.
Yeah. They weren't paying homage to him.
No, I don't think they were, but I wasn't there. So, you know, maybe they were, maybe they knew. I mean, after all, Voltaire had written very sharply against some of the situations that people found themselves in France in his day. And as we know, he had a house in Switzerland just across the border
yes.
from his normal country residence in eastern France, so that his servants, I think he always had servants on the lookout for the possibility of a coach that could have been full of gendarmerie or something coming to arrest him.
So the exile part, so they may be talking about Voltaire, that they were exiles like Voltaire. They were hiding on Zurich.
Yes, it might have been more complimentary than hostile to him.
Right. I think I was interrupted. You were starting to say another sentence, so you were saying...
I don't think I was going to say much, except that he had these servants, always got a servant on the watch. And if it was reported that the carriage looked suspicious, he would get on his horse or get in his other carriage as a something, and he'd head across the border into Switzerland.
I see, yeah.
So they had a good exemplar in Voltaire. Well, some of them made efforts at creating visual things. They had seen cubism. Now, we haven't talked about cubism, and I don't think we'll start today.
Right.
But cubism, they obviously thought, was sort of laughable. And so they thought, well, why don't we use cubism? And some of the things that they therefore came up with in the end, ended in a year or two by being collage and things like that, montage, where you stick bits of material from other sources, other journals with images and so on, into a work of art.
So
I don't think they made much art, but...
They're not thinking of themselves as performance artists. They didn't have those terms. But was there, like, performance art happening in the Café Voltaire?
I think that's the beginning of what we would call performance art. Yes.
Right, even though it wasn't called that. Now, they didn't respect cubism. Is that what you said?
Yes, my impression is that they used cubism as a method of sort of insulting people with things that were not art.
Right.
Just how deeply they really appreciated what Picasso and Braque had been doing in the couple of 3 years before they moved to Switzerland, I don't know.
Right.
It may be that they knew more than I'm presently aware of. Anyway, I wanted to point out that although they were cabaret people, they sang, and one or two of them were already poets. They also turned, and one or two people turned up who, in fact, were going to leave their mark on painting. The most important person among them who turned out to be an artist painter was Hans Arp, or Jean Arp.
Right, A-R-P. Did Duchamp make it over to Zurich?
No, Duchamp did not.
He actually was more in New York in 1917, right? He
escaped the draft by moving to New York.
Right, right.
And in fact, in 1917, when the Americans declared war, he left America and went to Argentina.
Really?
Oh, yes.
I didn't know that.
He was determined not to serve in such a stupid thing as a war. And he managed to escape. There may be a more complicated story to this. It may be that he was discovered to be flat-footed or something,
yeah.
which allowed him not to go, but gave him an uncomfortable time because, of course, it was quite popular on both sides of the war for young ladies to walk up to young men who weren't in uniform and, give them a white feather for cowardice.
Right.
So it could have become, for Duchamp and for anybody else who was doing that, quite legitimately, it could have been uncomfortable in any case. And besides, Duchamp had been the center of a sort of scandal two or three years before he left France in a show called the Armory Exhibition. But we won't go into that. I don't want to drag Duchamp into this. There's a book published in 1968. It was a catalog with a large essay on Dada and Surrealism and their heritage. And it was there, of course, that Duchamp died. He was in New York for the conference that happened during that exhibition.
Right.
He came, actually, and sat in front of me.
Wow.
You can believe it. There weren't too many people for the, I'm not sure what we'd call it, a consortium of people. Anyone could have gone.
Yeah.
But it was the work day, and I don't know why there would be empty seats, but there were plenty of empty seats, and he came in and chose the one in front of me. So that was the first time I saw him in the flesh. And later on, I saw him, I think it was later, certainly later, that I saw him in Toronto. Anyway, I don't want to bring him into
right.
it, but yeah. I disapprove of him being called a Dadaist.
Okay.
He was never involved in Europe, never joined any group, never called himself a Dadaist, though he could have said, I rather like the Dadaists, because they shared some of his attitudes. And the other thing is that very late in his stay in New York, a few people got going, and of course his famous urinal and so on, which for the time being, if we haven't discussed him, we might call a certain kind of hoax, when in fact it seemed to everybody to be a hoax, but in fact it was a fairly profound philosophical idea that it had occurred to him to use a urinal in an exhibition. Well, it never got in an exhibition, of course. Somebody made sure it didn't get in, even though it was passed, because there was no jury to send it back.
Right.
Anyway, enough of Duchamp. I just wanted to say these things about the Dadaists after the war. Dada moved to Germany particularly, and the people in Zurich moved to Paris. And there they continued to pursue their anarchist ways in having meetings, being unpleasant, and generally critical of the bourgeoisie and so on.
The first group went to Berlin, did you say?
Some of them did.
Some of them went to Berlin.
And some of them, the Berlin Dada, were in fact nowhere else but in the army during the war, but they turned up in Berlin, and there were one or two women too. They made a lot of use of this idea of montage and collage. Indeed, in some ways, that's what they're most known for.
We're talking about the trend of poets and artists getting together, and you're saying this distinction you're making in the history of art is caused by these cabarets. That's your point. That's where the painters and the...
where it begins.
Yeah, I see. Okay.
And, when the war ended, or even before the war ended, there were Dadaists in Berlin, and they were people totally disillusioned by the war. They had an extraordinary international Dada meeting or exhibition in Berlin in 1920. And if you look at photos of it, you see that on one wall someone has put a large canvas showing mutilated war veterans. On the ceiling, there's a pig dressed in the police uniform of the time, hanging from the ceiling.
Mm.
And all around it, there are notices and so on slamming out at the bourgeoisie and everybody else who might be called responsible for what had happened.
The great thing is that they avoided getting mutilated. They made the right move.
It was extraordinary, really, that they were never raided and beaten to death.
Yeah.
You know, by people who had survived. But it may be, you know, that that the sentiment around them was in agreement with them, that the war was terrible, that they should never have been at war, and that, you know, the result is what they were displaying, mutilation and horror. But that is basically what they stood for. So you have this kind of thing going on in Paris and in Berlin. And what next happens is that Dada sort of ends, because it was nihilistic in a way, and it was conscious of its nihilism. So that there came a point, and let's say it lasted until 1922. Let's actually give it a date. It lasted until 1922, and then it was as if everyone involved just lost energy to go on doing this same thing.
Right.
Now, meantime, they had done some pretty challenging things. I'm not going to, like, overburden us with names, but one of the most celebrated of the Berlin people once walked into a cathedral during a service, and he delivers an incredible anti-religious sermon.
He walks up into the pulpit, and you're saying it's, if there was going to be a dress, it wasn't scheduled that moment, so he hijacked it, you know, out of sequence, and then just started tirading.
That's right.
And back then, you could get in big trouble for that kind of stuff.
Yeah, obviously. Although, of course, the situation in Germany was so horrific that even that might have been allowed just to go on. People had to look for food every day. I mean, you know,
yeah,
starving. It was just terrible.
And you had Rosa Luxemburg and her gang, and then you had the right-wingers, the militarists, and they were shooting each other, killing each other. So it was
That was very important, of course, and I'm glad you bring it up, because, of course, the Russian Revolution had taken place in 1917, 1918, depending on how you look at it.
Yeah.
But by 1919, 1920, it was well established. There were people from lots of countries going to take a look to see what was happening and if it might work in their country.
Right.
As you know. So this was the same in Germany, and anything rather than what they had got seemed to be attractive, and this gave birth to Rosa Luxemburg and several others. So I think that's enough said about Dada. It was a nihilistic movement. People were left, as it dissolved, to look for something else to do. Well, it takes us back to the pre-war era in Italy. In the pre-war era in Italy, the kind of cabaret that we had was something like the cabaret was to become in Zurich. It was a place where the audience would be insulted, but it was a whole different attitude and philosophy from theirs. It was not at all nihilistic. It was very positive sort of philosophy, based really on Nietzsche again. And the person who set it going was a single individual. He had been educated in Paris, and he had written a manifesto that was published in the great Paris newspaper, Le Figaro. And this piece of propaganda for his cause read in a way which, of course, shocked everybody.
And this is about 1909, I think.
Right. And he alone wrote this, and he alone called it futurism. And his name, of course, was Federico Tommaso Marinetti.
Yes.
And his founding manifesto of futurism was printed in 1909 in Le Figaro. Now, the best way to introduce anybody to Futurism is to read from this manifesto. It is quite amusing in a way. So obviously, there's a seriousness underneath it because it's a sort of Nietzschean idea. But he does make it lighthearted, and I should think a lot of people read it just for the amusement of reading it. It begins like this. He says, "We had stayed up all night, my friends and I, under hanging musk lamps," and so on. He describes the situation in which they were in his wealthy flat. Suddenly, he says, "We jumped, hearing the mighty noise of the huge double-decker trams that rumbled by outside, ablaze with colored lights, like villagers on holiday suddenly struck and uprooted by the flooding River Po and dragged over falls and through gorges to the sea." So, right at the beginning, he has noticed that electric trams are running, while there really aren't any motor cars running, and people are using them as they use them today. And they're dashing past, and they're lit at night with colored electric lights, because, as we were saying a bit earlier, electricity and its various functions were well developed before the automobile.
Right.
Then he goes on to say that suddenly they had this urge to do something. He says, "Let's go," I said, "friends. Friends away, let's go. Mythology and the mystic ideal are defeated at last. We're about to see the centaur's birth, and soon after, the first flight of angels. We must shake the gates of life, test the bolts and hinges. Let's go," and so on. So he says, they get up, and like lions, we ran after death, and they got on their motorbikes. He's appealing to them to break out of the horrible shell of wisdom and throw ourselves like pride-ripened fruit into the wild, contorted mouth of the wind. And so he goes on. He says, "When I spun my car around," this is translated out, I wonder if that's right, "with the frenzy of a dog trying to bite its tail. And there suddenly were two cyclists coming towards me, shaking their fists, wobbling like two equally convincing but nevertheless contradictory arguments. Their stupid dilemma was blocking my way. Damn, ouch, I stopped short and to my disgust rolled over into a ditch with my wheels in the air. Oh, maternal ditch, full of muddy water, fair factory drain. I gulped down your nourishing sludge, and I remembered the blessed black breast of my Sudanese nurse. When I came up, torn, filthy, and stinking from under the capsized car, I felt the white, hot iron joy deliciously pass through my heart." So he's making a comical thing of it, but at the same time, he's really saying, you know, the new world with its factories, its cars, its electricity are what you need, and even the muddy water that they distill is better than the water you get from the tap. Now, the manifesto then goes on. "We intend to sing the love of danger, the habit of energy and fearlessness. 2, courage, audacity, and revolt will be the essential elements of our poetry. Up to now, literature has exalted a pensive immobility, ecstasy, and sleep. We intend to exalt aggressive action, a feverish insomnia, the racer's stride, the mortal leap, the punch and the slap. We affirm that the world's magnificence has been enriched by a new beauty, the beauty of speed, a racing car whose hood is adorned with great pipes, like serpents of explosive breath. A roaring car that seems to ride on grape shot is more beautiful than the victory of Samothrace." He says in the end, "We will glorify war, the world's only hygiene, militarism, patriotism, the destructive gesture of freedom bringers, beautiful ideas worth dying for, and scorn for women. So this is the kind of line that I did mention last time was being taken up by youth all over the place before the First World War.
Yeah.
We've run ahead because the futurists, maybe I should have mentioned futurists before I mentioned the Dadaists, but anyway.
Well, it led from the cabaret to the Dadaists.
That's right. So
yeah.
It leads also from the cabaret to the futurists, because the first thing they did was set up not a cabaret particularly, but futurist evenings in theaters that they would pay for. He says, the oldest of us is 30. We have at least a decade for finishing our work. When we are 40, other younger, stronger men will probably throw us in the wastebasket. We want it to happen.
Interesting. And the poetry of it, this is like the first media trend of youth. This is like beatniks or hippies or punks, right? This is the...
No, I mean, these guys were wealthy and, pretty well educated. I mean, he's a Sorbonne graduate and all the rest of it.
Well, the beatniks were educated, some of them. Ginsburg,
yes,
and
were.
Burroughs,
that's right.
But there is some people go back to the Jacobins, I think, around the time of the French Revolution, were their first youth gangs. But they had the name of their hat, the culottes, was it?
Culottes are their breeches. Anyway.
Yeah, so maybe it doesn't begin with the futurists, but he really gets going by getting this in the newspaper, right? That was a coup to get this manifesto in the newspaper.
Yes, I mean, suddenly out of the movement, which was this youth movement, as I said before, took place in most of the countries of Europe in the period before the First World War.
Yes, before.
He's aware of that. He's brought up and speaks French fluently. He's educated in France. And he would have come across this famous movement of the young men of today, or the young Frenchmen of today, which was a movement that recruited people with thoughts of getting out of the big city into the countryside, enjoying the fresh air and so on.
Right.
But at the same time, training for fitness and looking around for a way in which they could be challenged in the way that Nietzsche had written about in his Zarathustra.
You're saying that this French youth movement was happening before the futurists, and Marinetti hijacked that or got their attention.
Yes, that would be a good way to put it.
Yeah.
Now, that was in 1909. What he did in between 1909 and 1910, we can skip, but he attempted, let us say, to recruit friends. And by 1910, he'd got four or five artists who had joined him. And in 1910, they published their manifesto. It was called the Manifesto of Futurist Painting.
Mm.
And they said similar things. Let's just read a bit from it. The cry of rebellion which we utter associates our ideals with those of the futurist poets. Their ideas were not invented by some aesthetic clique. They are the expression of a violent desire which boils in the veins of every creative artist today. We will fight with all our might the fanatical, senseless, and snobbish religion of the past. So they're, as if we had read the full manifesto, we would have found that he attacks lots of establishments, the church, but also the museums.
Mm.
And he talks about the gangrene professors in the universities that teach art history. So pretty well everything that civilized people, well, the civilized society, that thought they were the civilized is being attacked.
Right.
And it's being attacked in the name of doing something that is challenging, and because it's challenging, it gives you a feeling of life and vitality.
We had in the architectural scene poets, painters joining architects. These are painters joining something that's already started, the poetic Marinetti, right?
Yes, the poetic Marinetti with any of his friends who'd chosen to join him, yes. And then, of course, they haven't been there too long before other people turn up, musicians. On my bookshelf, I've got a book which is quite a thick book called Futurist Manifestos. So a whole book full of their manifestos. And once the painters have started, the musicians turn up. And then the painters talk about their technical manifesto and what new things they might use, including the new matter of X-rays and so on.
Right, that's 1895. I know X-rays are 1895.
There you are. So the Manifesto of Futurist Musicians, I'm just turning the pages, the Futurist Manifesto of Photodynamism, by a fellow who was a photographer and did some amusing new things. And, of course, one of the things that they were able to adopt came from the photographers who were doing chronophotography. There's a French photographer called Marais who analyzed the galloping of a horse or analyzed the moments of a man on doing it's a famous photo of pole jumps by doing maybe 20 exposures for one pole jump or 20 exposures for 1 second as the horse came by.
Right.
And so they had the mnemonic of speed in these photos, and the painters began to use a variety of chronophotography in their actual painting. So you see one of them doing racing cars, and you can't really see what the car is. You can only see a cloud of dust with arrows and things going through it.
And this, people, just to remind, the context is that the new stuff just before that was realism. Courbet and those guys showing the peasant. Now you got this radical thing of making machines be the content of painting, right? That's shocking.
Yes, and you have to remember that between Courbet and them is 50 years of some of the matters we've been talking
yes.
about, new philosophies. The other philosopher that they looked at was Bergson.
Yes.
Bergson, who had written about time, and you might say the same of Nietzsche, but you'd have to make a good argument about Zarathustra being an existentialist tract.
Mm.
But you could certainly, in the same way, say that Bergson had invented an existentialist tract of another kind, but because for Bergson, his recommendation in regard to time was that really it didn't exist if you lived always in the present moment. And if you live in the present moment, you can't afford morals and you can't afford hesitations and you can't afford to consult yourself. You just go and do. And this is what Zarathustra did for Nietzsche.
Well, was Bergson analyzing time because of chronophotography?
Oh, no.
That wasn't the reason.
These things are developing separately in a huge context. I mean, no doubt everyone quickly saw Marais' photos. I mean, you know, they would have been published in journals and so on for everybody to know about. One just has to keep in mind that although there is often direct contact between various movements in the arts, they are surrounded by prodding and pushing from all kinds of things that are taking place in their environment.
Yeah. Wasn't Moybridge was the other photographer, chronophotographer,
He was American, surely.
Yes. So, but didn't they answer the question of whether the horse touched the ground and it's galloping or something?
Yes, what? I think they did. After them, people who drew horses racing drew them as they really were.
Yeah.
For the first time.
So here are the poets and painters. What is Mondrian and De Stijl and the Bauhaus thinking of Marinetti? Are they, the architect painter gang, are they ignoring the poet painters?
Yes, you know, there was only one architect that joined the Futurists, and he never built a building. In fact, I think he died rather young, but he was an interesting architect, obviously. In fact, if you look at the heating, Dalhousie University has a whole building with two or three high chimney stacks coming out of it at the roof level. And I think it heats a lot of Dalhousie University from there. But the outer design of it reminds us very much that someone certainly knew of this futurist architect.
A side point, is Gaudi before all this?
Yes. Gaudi was finishing his work at this time, but he was an older man, and he was very much in Art Nouveau, really.
Yeah.
But it was Art Nouveau with a Spanish touch and a curious Art Nouveau. Very attractive, of course, but very much not in the new movements that we're now discussing.
I'll just say the big influence of McLuhan was Wyndham Lewis, and Wyndham Lewis was certainly watching and responding. Remember his famous celebration of Marinetti when he comes to London in 1910, but then when Marinetti comes back in 1913, Lewis's gang reject Marinetti and try to make vorticism something more advanced than the Futurists. Lewis's main brag was, we've had machines for 50 years here in England. These are not a big phenomenon over here. You guys are naive. You're all excited about these machines, but we've gotten used to that. That was his argument to Marinetti.
The thing that interests us most about Marinetti is what he did for poetry.
Okay, that's interesting. What did he do?
What he did, if you want to put it in technical terms, the medium of poetry is semantic. It's words.
Mm.
It's not iconic. I'm using a sort of specialized idiom here.
Yeah.
It's not iconic. You're not drawing a picture with the words. But Marinetti decided that he would change that, and that what he would do, for instance, it's best to actually quote from something he actually did rather than generalize about it. He writes a poem about a young woman who is reading a letter from her lover who is in the war. Now, the war has started, of course, so this poem shows a little drawing of her leaning on her elbow in the bottom corner, reading something that is obviously not readable to the viewer. And all around her, there are letters that shape like shell bursts or noises. The whole thing gives you the visual impression of a battlefield, even though it is words. And you can read the words. There's something like zoom, boom, bang, bong, and so on. So what he did was really change the semiotics by iconic means of meaning along with the semantic means that poetry has usually had. But we have had onomatopoeia, of course, in poetry. And in France, particularly in the 1830s, there was some very interesting stuff done by some French authors. The book, it's called Le Roi de Bohème. In short, The King of Bohemia. And by Bohemia, it means the Bohemian life of the artists, of course. And in this, There is a lot of play with words, and particularly with onomatopoeic words, so that the guy's in a carriage and all you get in the poem is the different sounds as the horses go over a bridge or whatever.
Right.
But that's not quite Marinetti. He does do something quite more radical. There was a very strong movement in the middle of the 19th century in France among the poets called the Parnassiens, referring to the Parnassus of Greek myth. And they wanted a certain kind of technical, well, it wouldn't be fair to say rigidity, but they wanted certainly to appeal to proper technique, and they had limits to whom they would include in that.
Yeah, remember the Oulipo movement in the 50s and 60s and the Lettres in France? Are they retrieving the 1830s and 40s stuff? Is that what you...
You might say that. You might also say they were retrieving the futurist, Marinetti's futurist.
Right. Okay, so you were explaining the semiotics and semantics of this revolution that Marinetti pulled off. You want to say a little bit more of that, or where it leads, or what's the point here of his...
I'd like to say a few more things, if I can, about the general attitude that was shared among the futurists.
Yeah.
We have said that the tradition of the bohemian attitude towards the average individual, the idea that you could play tricks, you could astonish people, that you could be an anarchist. All this happened in the cabarets. There was Nietzsche and Bergson to deal a death blow to symbolism.
Yeah.
And link everything up to the future. We should remember, though, that Marinetti was in Paris exactly when Jarry's Ubu Roi and several other things were going on, so that he'd seen, or had the possibility of seeing at any rate, some of the outrageous things that went on. And of course, Jarry was marvelous for outrageous things. His story, The Superman, is really a first-rate, amusing novel.
Mm.
This will amuse you because it's someone who takes a potion rather like you were describing to me the other day when you were talking about the...
Our RNA drops?
Yes, the RNA drops. And he takes this potion and he becomes sort of infinitely strong.
Mm.
And the potion is used by people, for instance, who join a challenge to race the Siberian Express across Russia on a bicycle. But it's a bicycle for 10 men. I don't know what you call a bicycle for 10 men. I don't know. It has two wheels, so maybe it's still a bicycle, but there are 10 men pedaling it. And it claims that with this liqueur, they can make this bicycle go faster than the transcontinental.
Mm.
And halfway through, and this is part of Jarry's, dark humor, halfway through, one of them dies, but his feet are strapped to the pedals, and they can't stop, of course. So although he's dead, he seems to be continuously pedaling, and then they realize he actually is pedaling, although he's dead, because he took this elixir.
Yeah.
And then there's another part of it in which the Superman is tested for the number of women with whom he can have sexual intercourse.
At one go.
That's right, in before he's exhausted. And the daughter of the man who makes the challenge and so on realizes that this is her chance to get a lot of sex with one of the best males around. So she manages to sneak into the room where the, I'm tempted to say victim, but in fact she turns out not to be a victim. And when she comes in, of course, a little group of them all are looking down through peepholes in the ceiling at this display. And her father is there, and he is very discomforted to find who is going to be the woman who's equally with it.
Yeah, that sounds like the RNA drops. Excellent little plug for the RNA drops there.
So Dada obviously does inherit something from them as well as from the cabarets.
Yeah.
But they are, the big difference between Dada and futurists is that the futurists are applauding the idea of war. Of course, war hasn't begun when they do this. But the Dadaists are all pacifists. That's the big difference.
Yeah.
Otherwise, there isn't too huge a difference between the way in which they present themselves to the public with their performances. You previously suggested that this is where performance art begins, and I think you're right. You'd have to have a look at performance art.
Yeah.
I've just remembered that, of course, fascism was going to start up soon after the war, but its anthem was something that you can think would have been familiar to the futurists.
Mm.
It goes, Giovinezza, Giovinezza, Primavera, di bellezza, which is youth, youth, the beautiful spring of life. So it's, again, it's this appeal to youth that is behind the fascists even, as well as the futurists. And some of the futurists are going to become fascists, and Marinetti is to be really praised for what he has given the youth and what he's given fascism, and he accepts that. He's a member of the fascist party by the time it begins.
Which is in 1922, and Mussolini has Marinetti as a kind of advisor, or at least he praises Marinetti.
Right.
Mussolini does.
So when the war came, they were all sort of rubbing their hands and saying, well, now there's a chance, boys, to live in the present. And this is what several people who survived the war, both in Germany and in Britain, actually did. There were a few people in the war who found themselves enhanced by charging the enemy. It's amazing, but they did.
You're saying that they would charge on the field, the enemy, and get all inflated, you know, the adrenaline going.
And there was a fellow who became very famous who went back to the trenches 13 times after being wounded 13
times. Wow. He loved it so much.
Because he found it exhilarating. That's right. It's amazing, but there we are. And a few people besides him did take that up. Well, the futurists rubbed their hands and offered themselves to the army, and much to their great annoyance, they were all sent to work with a corps of bicycle riders, not motorbikes, but
right,
just ordinary bicycles, who took messages from one part to another. And that was not very suitable for them, of course. They weren't very happy at all. They thought they might get motorbikes. They thought they might get guns and fire or even bayonets and charge, but they found themselves rushing around on
as a bike messenger.
Bike messenger.
Yes. That's the best they got. But what's interesting, you got two forms of collage artists, one going pacifist and the other going extremely military or militant. Two types right there at the same time with similar art styles.
I think that's really enough said. But there was this little streak running through futurism, which was the streak of being exhilarated as a young person, which was the general trend among the middle-class youth of many European countries, and which helped to produce the war. I mean, they would write articles, they would be at universities and form groups, and university people in those days would come out, and their fathers might even be generals in the army,
right,
waiting for a war to happen. So there is a curious, fairly intangible thesis to, but it should be mentioned.
Yeah. Now, is there a movie that you're aware of that was made, a drama, There's the movie, I think it's by Ken Russell, The Savage Messiah, about Henri Gordier-Bresusca, the sculptor that Ezra Pound and Wyndham Lewis promoted. But is there a movie of that period that you know of made by Hollywood or European films showing these youth?
I think it often occurs as a chapter in a book where the hero or the hero's son or something goes to war and comes back invalided or whatever.
Right.
But I can't answer your question. I would have thought there would have been. Of course, there was All Quiet on the Western Front, which I think is probably, certainly is a movie that fills that a spot, I think.
Yes.
I mean, All Quiet on the Western Front begins with the youth, and they are, many of them, willing and ready to go. Then they find out that it's not what they thought.
Right.
So they have to endure it and come back, some of them dead, some of them wounded, and the others disillusioned.
Okay, so by way of wrapping this up, this poet aligning with painters with poets, does that carry on in New York or Europe and other movements?
Yes, and particularly in Surrealism.
Thank you very much, Dennis. And we will return with part six and sometime over the next month or so. Meanwhile, enjoy this part five with Dennis Young holding forth here. Okay, thanks a lot, Dennis.
My pleasure.